Good morning. This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And today by phone from a long way away in Australia, we're speaking with professor, writer, and author Geoffrey Miller about his new book, Spent: Sex, Evolution, and Consumer Behavior. Thanks for taking the time and coordinating with us for this interview.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here, Michelle.
All right. Well, before we talk about your new book, can you give us a little background of kind of what informed your writing of this book and your training? I know that you're a professor of evolutionary psychology, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I work at University of New Mexico, and at the moment I'm on sabbatical in Brisbane, Australia.
Yes.
The background to the book is really from my interest in human nature. I mean, evolutionary psychology is trying to figure out how human nature works by thinking about the kinds of challenges of survival and reproduction that faced our ancestors in prehistory from over the last few million years. And so we try to understand the emotions and motivations and beliefs and desires that drive human behavior. And for a long time, I focused just on human mating and human sexuality. But the motivation for this new book, Spent, was the realization that consumer behavior is a really central part of modern culture, and I wanted to understand that better.
Yes. Well, one of the really nice things that I got from reading the book is that it's such a refreshing expanse. The time frame that is so large was really comforting in that it took it out of the immediate and put it in some great context. You did a great job putting it in context.
Yeah, I hope that it's some comfort for people who are worried about the global financial crisis or how the American economy will do and when it faces competition from China and India, to reassess the nature of consumerist capitalism from this deep time perspective, to think, well, what would our ancestors of a million years ago have thought about modern lifestyles, and how can we rethink our behavior from that point of view, where we're just a tiny transient speck out of the whole epic history of humanity.
Yes, it really, and the book really does do a nice job, like I said, of broadening it out. You say that the book has two main aims. The first is to describe our human culture as it is within our biological context. And the second is to suggest some way that we could change our human culture so it more happily combines the best features of our prehistoric social life and modern technology. So I guess we should start with first things first, our biology that we come to it, our biological selves in the book that you talk about.
Yeah, I think a major point of the book is that survival of the fittest is a very misleading term for how evolution works. A lot of what animals like us do is actually display our qualities to other animals. We try to show how great we are in terms of how our bodies work and how our brains work in order to attract mates and attract friends and convince our relatives that we're worth interacting with, and also when young, to convince our parents that we're worth investing in. So an awful lot of evolution has to do with display. And you can see that in nature, all the way from the peacocks showing off their tails to the bowerbirds creating wonderful bowers to attract females, to baby birds begging with big, bright, open gapes to get food from their parents. So what I tried to do was understand runaway consumerism as another form of display. And I tried to ask, what is it exactly that humans are trying to display when we're buying Porsches or MAC lipstick or getting advanced college degrees?
Yes, I mean, because you do expand it out instead of, it says, throughout most of the 20th century, psychologists assumed that the biological legacy gave us just a few simple instincts to survive and reproduce, and that everything else was due to learning and culture. And you're saying, no, there's much more to it.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it, and it's wonderful to be able to connect these instincts for self-display to all the aspects of human culture. I mean, the particular way that we display, let's say, our intelligence or our kindness certainly differs hugely across different cultures and throughout history. So in ancient China, you might have displayed your intelligence by passing the imperial civil service exam and becoming governor of a province. And you might have displayed your agreeableness by being kind to beggars or keeping peace. In modern society, we do it different ways, but I think the fundamental traits that we're trying to display are very similar. And that similarity underneath the great variety of human culture is really what the book's starting point.
Yes. You might want to further tell us about the fitness indicators, kind of the central six traits that you posit.
Yeah, the central six traits that I think are being displayed most often in consumerism are what psychologists call the big five personality traits plus general intelligence. General intelligence is pretty familiar to us. It's basically just IQ or reasoning ability, the sort of thing that leads people to perform well in school or on the job. The big five personality traits aren't quite as familiar, but they're also, I think, very easy to understand. They consist of openness to experience, which is our interest in having new, novel experiences, appreciating art, music, new ideas, new cultures. So that's openness. There's conscientiousness, which is fulfilling promises and obligations, planning for the future, keeping a good credit rating. And then there are three others that we can talk about later. But the key idea is these big five personality traits and general intelligence, they're universal across cultures. They've been found everywhere that humans exist. They seem to be universal across history. They're all heavily influenced by the genes that you inherit from your parents, and they're also very stable across the lifespan. And finally, they predict a wide range of behaviors, so they're very worth displaying to others, and we can actually assess them pretty well when we see them being displayed by others.
So, as you speak in the book, it's rather than trying to deny that or You take some central questions about why would somebody, well, you can explain about a Hummer. Give us that little scenario.
Yeah, so the question that really motivated the book was if humans are so smart, then why would anybody buy a Hummer Alpha H1 sports utility vehicle? They're no longer sold, but when they were, this is the original Hummer that cost about $140,000. It was not very reliable according to consumer reports. It got very poor gas mileage. It's not a very convenient commuter vehicle. But it is a very reliable indicator of a few traits. One, you can afford it. And in a meritocracy like ours, where to some degree your education predicts your occupational success and your income, to some degree then your wealth is sort of a reflection of your intelligence that you had to have to be able to succeed in a complex and demanding job. And also it's an indicator of your conscientiousness, your ability to get your homework done when you're in school, to show up at work on time when you've got a job, and to save money or at least maintain a good enough credit score that you can buy the thing. The Hummer also, for a lot of young males, is a very good indicator of aggressiveness. It shows that I'm a tough guy. I'm a bad boy. I'm on the mating market. I'm probably single. And if you want to hook up with somebody who's not Mr. Nice, then come see me in my Hummer. And that's very explicit if you look around Saudi Arabia, where young men will actually paint their email addresses and mobile phone numbers on the sides of their huge SUVs in hopes that women will contact them.
Yeah, well, and this plays into the fitness indicator about the purpose of that requires males and females to kind of follow different strategies and display their fitness indicators. And you say that it's across virtually all animal species that males display mostly to attract female mates and less often to intimidate male rivals. But you also go into, you might want to explain that a little bit. And then you go into, this was very interesting, that the situation is more complex for females, that females, animals of most species, gain little benefit from displaying fitness indicators to either sex.
Yeah, that's the general species across, the general pattern across most species is that males display more and females are choosier. But the distinctive thing about humans is we have this system of mutual mate choice where at least when we're forming long-term partnerships like marriages,
uh-huh.
males may display more at first, but then females also have reasons to display to attract these commitment-phobic guys to actually get them to settle down. And over the long term, it turns out that males and females are about equally choosy, and males and females do about equal amounts of display. They just do it in slightly different strategies. The males tend to broadcast their displays more publicly to a larger variety of women. The women tend to narrow cast their displays just to particular males that they're interested in. And so I think a lot of patterns of consumer behavior make sense from that point of view, that the males are sort of trying to send signals of how great they are in all possible directions to all possible women. Women are more targeting the men they care about with their displays.
Oh, and so that this is all, the book is all about trying to help understand our behavior as consumers. I find it, it was very interesting and nice to go from Maslow's hierarchy. Just feels so inadequate to explain how much consumption and how driven it has become in our lifetimes.
Yeah, I think it's very hard, even from professional marketers, to really understand what consumers are doing. They tend to rely on these outdated psychological theories from 50 or 60 years ago, like Abraham Maslow's famous hierarchy of needs, where the basic needs have to do with food and security and safety, and then we have social needs for belongingness and acceptance and love, and then we have these self-actualization needs like achieving enlightenment or transcendence or whatever. But it's actually very hard to understand what consumers are really doing using that kind of model of what motivates people. I've found it really helpful to think about how is it exactly that we're trying to show off these big five personality traits and general intelligence to potential lovers and friends. And a lot of what gets called self-actualization, for example, people learning to express themselves through poetry or music or painting or meditation or things like that, those actually turn out to be displays just as much as wearing fashionable clothing is.
Right.
They tend to be displays that require other kinds of goods and services. You have to buy the instrument and the music and get music lessons and all of that. But capitalism provides those goods and services equally well, whether you're trying to display your creativity and intelligence or whether you're simply trying to display your wealth.
Well, and I appreciate that the book doesn't require a background or expertise in psychology or anthropology. And as a matter of fact, you state that the less you've been taught about traditional marketing and economics, the fewer misconceptions you'll have to overcome.
Yeah, I think business schools are doing a real disservice, not only to the students, but to society, because they're teaching business managers and marketers all the wrong things about human nature. They tend to use an economic model that assumes consumers are more or less rational, and that when they're not rational, they're simply relying on weird emotions to to make their decisions. And what counts as rational in modern economics is maximizing your own happiness or utility or pleasure. So the assumption in business schools at the moment is people are running around as pleasure-seeking machines, and they're buying anything they can that maximizes pleasure. Actually, that doesn't really describe consumer behavior very well at all. We spend a lot of money on things that don't bring us pleasure, but that we think will be good displays. So, for example, most Americans now go to college. They're not going to college because they enjoy it. They're going there because they need the credential. They need the piece of paper that says, basically, I was bright enough and conscientious enough to survive getting a university degree. And they spend tens of thousands of dollars on college degrees. It's not because college is fun or interesting or pleasurable. It's because people now in contemporary American society have to show that they have a college degree in order to get a job, to be socially reputable, to attract a good mate.
And we've even gone further and said there's levels of the degrees that matter in terms of the Ivies versus a community college. We also bring a social judgment about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's remarkable how finely tuned people are to differences in status among different college degrees. I mean, when we hear about other cultures, like, let's say, Japanese society, where people seem to have very baffling and subtle ways of distinguishing social status based on skill at flower arranging or the cut of your business suit, it's very confusing. But in American society, we have an equally huge degree of tacit knowledge about which is higher status, a degree from Harvard or UC Berkeley or Cal State Fullerton or University of Texas at Austin. We learn over the course of adolescence and adulthood to rank thousands of colleges in terms of relative merit and selectiveness. And we also learn what kinds of master's degrees, for example, are higher status. An MBA versus a master's in fine art versus a master's in philosophy, you can sort of know, I'd rather have my daughter marry a guy who's got the MBA rather than the MA in philosophy.
So it all ties.
So we're very, very finely tuned to these discrepancies in status and what all these degrees indicate about the underlying traits of the person who has the degree.
I want to remind our listeners that Jeffrey Miller will be speaking in Portland as part of the Illahi Lecture Series. His topic is The Evolution of Desire, and you can hear him on Wednesday, May 20th at the First Congregational Church, which is 1126 Southwest Park in Portland at 7:30 p.m. And I also want to remind him that we're speaking about his new book, Spent, Sex, Evolution, and Consumer Behavior. Well, there's nobody in this culture that is not inundated, aware of, compelled, and fraught with all of the consumer-driven realities. You contend that there's a kind of a clash of philosophies, though, between, say, the anti-capitalist, anti-corporate contingent and the WTO free market supporters. Can you give us a little bit more insight in how you see both of those as flawed in terms of their black and white reaction to the markets?
Yeah, I think the anti-consumerist, anti-capitalist skeptics who tend to be greens and try to buy organic and tend to buy Toyota hybrid cars and so forth, they think that they're entirely opting out of consumerism by following the lifestyles that they are. But big corporations understand very well that they're simply seducing this different market segment, the greens and the crunchies and the hippies and so forth. They're seducing them with a different set of products, They're seducing them with the Whole Foods grocery stores and the hybrid cars and alternative music and so forth, which are equally profitable and equally well marketed. So it's not that you can opt out entirely of consumerism very easily. Also, the skeptics tend to think that markets and money are bad things. I think, on the contrary, free markets are the best invention ever in human civilization. They hugely increase human welfare, and the gains from trade that people get by having voluntary exchanges of goods and services, and that's terrific. It works a whole lot better than a command economy or attempts at communism or attempts at barter. But on the other hand, I think the greens and crunchies and hippies are perfectly valid in saying there are better ways to demonstrate the traits that other people care about than buying a McMansion or a Hummer. There are much cheaper ways to do it. There are alternative ways to do it. You can show that you're a kind, agreeable, and bright person without having to go through formal education, get a law degree, become a corporate lawyer, make a bunch of money, spend it, donate a bunch of money to charity. You don't have to do that. You can basically just talk to people, and people are amazingly good at judging our personalities just through ordinary conversation. So the idea that you can opt out of capitalism to some degree by simply talking more to your friends and lovers and consuming less is valid. That's perfectly reasonable.
So you're saying that evolutionary psychology can kind of offer a deeper, more radical critique of the consumerist culture.
Yeah, I think, Marx was great and Adam Smith was great, and the economic analysis of consumerism has made a lot of progress, but Darwin also offers a lot of insights into what we're doing when we work and shop. And I think if a consumer is not armed with these Darwinian insights, that consumer is much easier to exploit. So I think of getting these evolutionary psychology insights as a way of consumers being able to defend themselves against runaway advertising and marketing and consumer debt. I think it's a way of empowering consumers to realize their own foibles and what they're prone to do if they don't know better.
Yes. Well, can you take us through, there were several instances in the book, but maybe some of the studies that reveal so much about us, maybe like the discount rates by Margot Wilson and Martin Daly, maybe if you could just give us a piece of that.
Yeah, so what Martin Daly and Margot Wilson found, they're psychologists in Canada, is that if you take a bunch of young men and young women and you expose them to pictures or thoughts of the opposite sex, and you make them think about mating and the importance of mating and the attractiveness of potential lovers, that will shift the behavior of the men and women in economic terms, in terms of saying, how much money would I take tomorrow versus today? How impatient am I with regard to money? Basically, if you make people more interested in mating, they become more impatient. They would require a higher interest rate to actually put money into a savings account, for example. And they have a stronger tendency to spend their money right now, particularly on conspicuous luxuries. So the Daly and Wilson study showed that you can easily shift people's economic behavior in ways that look irrational at first, but that actually make quite a bit of sense. Because for a biologist, if you have a mating opportunity right in front of you, it does make sense to invest more time and energy and resources in trying to attract that mate and to be impatient and not to think so much about the amount of debt that you're going into that you might have to pay back in 10 years' time.
So that's just
an example of how easy it is, for example, for sexually oriented advertising to get people to overspend, to get them into deeper consumer debt.
Yes. Do you Do you, and I want to end on something called a civil society, but do you think that there has been a major or radical or at least a momentary redefining due to this enormous economic crisis that we seem to be in now? Do you think this is kind of a wake-up call? Are you hopeful?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely a wake-up call. And a lot of people around the world are feeling like, well, we still love consumerism, but consumerism doesn't love us anymore. Boo-hoo. And what are we going to do about it? A lot of the dreams and aspirations people had of predicting careers with ever higher status and ever higher earnings and an ever better lifestyle are being challenged now by the global financial crisis. And some people are having a rethink, and they're stepping back and trying to reevaluate their lives and their habits. But a lot of them don't really have the intellectual tools to do that very effectively. They don't really know how consumerist capitalism works in the first place, and that makes it really hard to reevaluate their role within the consumerist capitalist society. So what I hope that my book does, along with a lot of the other books that are coming out now, is to sort of empower consumers to rethink their lifestyles, to ask, what do I really want from life? What are the best ways to display my personality traits and my intelligence to the people I really care about, my friends and lovers and relatives? And can I display those traits in ways that don't require workaholism and shopaholism?
Well, you say it really well in a little something called A Civil Society. You say that we assume that if it's not the law, it must reside in the private sphere where personal tastes are beyond public discussion, and that because we've been brainwashed from birth to ignore all forms of social organization and cultural power that exist at levels of description other than the idealized constitution or corporations or the atomized individual. In other words, we do need to more heavily rely on a relearning and a retooling of how we got here and what it really is filling us up with, and maybe some new social norms and customs. You end on kind of a hopeful note, talking about changing social cultural traditions and accountability. Do you want to give us?
Yeah, I'm hugely optimistic that humans are bright enough and insightful enough to rethink their economic and consumer behavior and to find better ways to live. A lot of that has to do with creating and sustaining social norms that are a little different from what we've done so far. At the moment, in most of American middle-class society, the social norm is get the highest advanced degree from a university that you can possibly get, and then work as hard as you possibly can before you get married, and then keep working as hard as you possibly can without neglecting your children too badly, and also get into as much consumer debt as you can possibly afford. That's obviously not bringing a lot of happiness to most people. And a big point of my book spent is to really remind people that there are much more natural and fulfilling ways that we can display our personal traits to others in much more direct ways through human conversation and music and art and hobbies and crafts and ordinary social interaction, that we don't have to try to display ourselves in such roundabout, convoluted ways through working hard and shopping hard.
Well, I want to thank you for taking your time and getting up early, continents away. The book, again, is Spent, Sex, Evolution, and Consumer Behavior by Jeffrey Miller. And it is a very informative look at why we do what we do, and that is the key to very helpful in understanding it and decoupling it, which will make the future, I'm sure. I mean, people are really craving. I think they know this isn't it. They're just not sure why or how, and the book really helps inform and enlighten on that level.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for being with us. All right.
Okay.
Bye now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay.